Now, you may get sick of hearing about this, but it never ceases to amaze me this year. April 25th, and there is a winter storm advisory for most of Minnesota. The rest of the country gets a good giggle out of that because we're pretty much laughing about it up here in the upper Midwest. About 12 inches possible, up to 12 inches of snow for large parts of the state, and it's almost May. Of course, the upper Midwest is glad to be getting the water. Again, it looks like everybody has their eyes on this water, too. More on that in crypto news. Plus, the story of the Smiley Face Murder Club. Before we get to open lines on the way on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett in for George Norrie tonight with a face for radio and a voice for print. Before we go any further, allow me to go back to last Saturday. As many of you heard, and many more may have heard about, last Saturday's show on Coast to Coast generated a lot of email. For those of you who wrote to say that you were glad I stood my ground or that I was a worthy adversary to the guest, I want to say respectfully that you're wrong, because I was wrong. I should not have been so adversarial. Sometimes that's needed and appreciated on this show, but last Saturday night, I was wrong to stand my ground so strongly, even if I passionately disagreed with the direction that the show was going with Steve Quayle. If I didn't create the contest of wills, and I may have, then I definitely contributed to it. It's a little complicated. But no matter what else was going on, Steve Quayle deserved a better host than I was last Saturday. For those of you who wrote to say that you expected more of me, you were correct. Steve Quayle was correct when he suggested there was some kind of miscommunication going on before the show, but I was too myopic to see that he was right and too hooked to be able to get out of that gear. I fear that the truth was that I was unprofessional in my concern. I know why, of course. I have struggled with it all week. Only my wife has heard me talk about it, but I just wanted to make the point that I have an email that has haunted me for a couple of years from somebody who was reacting to a guest that we had on the old Coast to Coast live show, who was particularly doomy and gloomy that night, offering no hope for humanity. And one person reached out to me to say that they wanted to kill themselves after listening to the guest. And I wrote back a passionate reply as to, it's not that bad, hang in there. And I even read it on the air. Some of you might remember I read part of that letter on the air and responded to it. And I never heard back from that person. And I, for all I know, it's a hoax, it was a prank, or next week, the guy won the lottery and is living in Miami with a Rockette. But it just hooked me. And I promised after that I would always do a show with at least a ray of hope, no matter how doomy and gloomy the subject was. And that's why I kept separating myself out from this show last Saturday and kept saying, this is Steve's opinion. That's what was hooking me. And I kept thinking about something Art Bell said once after 9/11. And if you remember, we pulled a bunch of extra shifts back then after 9/11. And I always remembered something that Art said that gave me quite a bit of hope. He said, let's just keep our caps on and we'll get through this. And I just believe that. And yeah, things are pretty scary right now. Maybe it's a reflection of the fact that I'm scared, more scared than I want to admit. Walmart's rationing bags of rice, for God's sakes. I mean, it is what it is. But I always want to think that there's hope, because I'm always worried about some guy, some father of two out there who might have lost his job and is feeling like life's not worth going on. So that's what was getting to me. And it was unfair to put into the middle of the show, but that's where I was. I was unprepared for what happened, for where we went with it. And I no doubt overreacted. I'm sure everything's fine. Earlier in the week, I invited Steve back with the promise that we'd play it any way he wanted to. I hope he takes me up on it. I still may not agree with him, but I promised not to be such a big fat drag about it. And while I'm in apologizing mode, let me throw in one to all my colleagues, including George, who had to hear so much about it this week. True reconciliation is an organic process. It cannot be managed. It should never be a hasty peace. But I hope that helps. Time for some crypto news. Before we do, open lines coming up in the hours ahead. Word about potential water wars are flooding in. The case of the ascending priest. U.S. troops ate Saddam Hussein's lunch and ended up without any of their own. And the true life breaking news of a gang you've never heard before. And a gang you really hope doesn't actually exist, but very well might be out on the streets tonight. The Smiley Faced Murder Club. Well, you'll hear about it coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. A little crypto news to relieve the tension before we get to this very scary news story coming up with a local reporter here in the Twin Cities, a story that you will be hearing more about. I know the Canadian press, however, has a story from Toronto. Parched U.S. states could start water wars in the years ahead and fight for access to Great Lakes resources as they become more desperate to meet growing needs. That, according to Canadian and American experts at a water conference, southwestern U.S. states are already concerned about dwindling water resources, and the impacts on climate change are exacerbating the problems. That, according to Environment Canada's Linda Morch, who worked on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, according to these reports, water issues that are currently emerging will develop into bitter conflicts in the not-too-distant future when those dry states become increasingly desperate, said Milton Clark, a senior health and science advisor for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We will, in fact, get into major water wars, said Clark. You will see water wars coming in every way, shape, or form. In the U.S., there are some leading politicians who have said the Great Lakes do, in fact, belong to everyone, and all water should be nationalized. This certainly is a concern, said the Canadians. Earlier this month, Ohio Lieutenant Governor Lee Fisher made headlines when he told an economic development summit the Great Lakes region may be less than a decade away from selling water to U.S. other states in need. So, you know, if Canada is going to siphon off any water, they ought to hurry up and get out their hosers. From Brazil, Brazil's Air Force has suspended its search for a Roman Catholic priest who vanished after sailing into thin air under a cluster of colorful balloons. The cleric's family chartered a private plane to continue the hunt. The Reverend Adelier Antonio de Carli has been missing since Sunday, when he lifted off from the port city of Paranagua, strapped to 1,000 balloons and wearing a helmet, an aluminum thermal flight suit, waterproof coveralls, and a parachute. Denise Gallas, the treasurer of Father De Carli's parish, said his family chartered a twin-engine plane after several parishioners said that they had, quote, premonitions that he had landed near a small town on the coast of one of the states of Brazil. We remain as confident as ever that he is still alive, she said. Our faith is unshakable. According to Gallus, the priest hoped his flight would help raise money for a center where truck drivers could stop to rest and receive the gospel. Very sad. Crazy, but very sad. Let's hope his parishioners are right. Oklahoma City, according to Associated Press, U.S. Representative Mary Fallon said she's investigating allegations that members of the Oklahoma National Guard's 45th Infantry Brigade are not being regularly fed in Iraq. Fallon, who's a Republican for Oklahoma, replaced a small formal request Thursday for the Army to look into the accusations, according to her spokesman. The father of an Oklahoma soldier notified Oklahoma City television station KOCO after receiving an email from his daughter, Christy Fleshman, a member of the Oklahoma National Guard serving in Iraq. Quote, I have the ultimate respect for our military and for the job they do and for the sacrifices they make and for the well-being of all of us, Howard Fleshman told the TV station. And so it's only out of this concern and the concern for the well-being of Oklahoma soldiers that I'm raising the issue in the first place. So for those serving in Iraq, I think the least we can do is serve them lunch. But isn't it interesting to see the place that this TV station is playing in that story? Same thing down here in New Orleans. Quote, it's like putting a Band-Aid on the hole of a gas tank of an airplane. That, according to a resident of St. Bernard Parish, what he's talking about was shoddy work done by a contractor hired by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This in a story run by Eyewitness News down in New Orleans. Instead of an airplane, it's a flood wall, though, and instead of a Band-Aid, the witness said 2 years ago he saw the contractor filling the expansion joint or opening between the flood walls with newspapers. The whole length of the wall was stuffed with newspaper. When he confronted the contractor blamed Washington for the substandard work. He basically told me when Congress sent down the money, it would be repaired the proper way. Eyewitness News in New Orleans is investigating. Engineers tell the TV station an expansion joint has three lines of defense. The first is an elastic strip that helps keep water out. In the middle is the most important part, a water stop, which is in fact included in the St. Bernard flood wall. However, the missing part is a rubber joint that goes in between those two things that keeps foreign objects out, and that's what's filled with newspaper. The witness who talked to Eyewitness News said the contractor used the newspaper in place of the rubber joint. See, now that's a plan. I mean, the old dirt levees didn't hold so well. So heading into hurricane season, let's see if paper mache levees work any better this year. Well, good work, at least on the part of the TV station for doing that investigation and for TV station 5 Eyewitness News here in the Twin Cities. Full disclosure, it's owned by the company that I work with during the week and who runs Coast to Coast on AM 1500 KSTP. Christy Peel is an award-winning journalist for 5 Eyewitness News, and along with several other members of the 5 Eyewitness News team, she's been tracking a story which is just about to break big nationwide. You're hearing about it first on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, Christy.
Good evening.
I understand that you've got a family and they would probably love to have mom back. So thank you so much for giving us your time on this late night.
That's all right. They're sleeping. They don't even know that I'm not sleeping either.
Okay, good news. This club, I referred to them as the Smiley Face Murder Club, but I'm jumping ahead a few steps in the story. What is it that the FBI or local police or the investigators you've spoken with, what are they calling this potential group?
You know, the police are and the FBI are basically saying that it doesn't exist. So they're not giving it any name at all. The two retired New York detectives that have found all of this are hesitant to call it anything. I told them, well, as soon as this thing breaks, it's going to be the smiley face killers, and they kind of expected that.
Okay. So then let's just go with that. For the purposes of having a handy epithet, we'll just say smiley face killers. Now let's start at the beginning. You know, and I know, anybody here in the upper Midwest has been following a story that's been developing over the last decade or so of young college men coming back from parties or bars that have gone missing. And the story usually starts with a mom, a dad, a fraternity house, kids out there stapling pictures of these missing boys onto telephone poles and around town saying, have you seen this guy? Give folks who don't know the story a glimpse into how many young men we're talking about.
These detectives think that they can link at least 40 men since 1997 across the country. They believe that they can go from coast to coast, from states all over the country, and it's possible that there are more cases out there, but these are the cases that they feel they've got a really good link to.
It was a pattern we saw, especially here in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa. This story just got repeated over and over again. College men coming home from a bar, walking by themselves, disappearing, and after prolonged searches and a lot of hand-wringing, then suddenly the bodies show up weeks, months later in various rivers. That's always been the pattern. Those are all the sort of the basic elements to the story, correct?
That's right. And the other thing that continues to repeat is the kind of victim, so to speak. These guys are always quite athletic. They're very academically astute. They're good-looking guys. They're within just a few inches of each other, same body type. They really fit the same profile. And that's one of the things that I think here in the Midwest has really driven this idea that, gosh, it just can't be a coincidence.
Okay. And I'm really glad you mentioned that. They're all good-looking kids, by and large. And when these stories kept coming up, we just kept thinking, oh, come on, it can't be another kid that got drunk and slipped and fell into the Mississippi or fell into fill-in-the-blank river. It seemed like, oh, not again, it was happening. But over and over and over again, local police investigating these stories kept coming up with the fact that they kept saying it was an accident. It was an accidental drowning or a suicide. They kept coming back to that, those two conclusions. Explain why the police would do that.
You know, what these detectives are telling me is that in this whole story, they're not trying to go after police departments. They understand what's happened. They think that if you're a police officer in a small town, some of these are real small towns where this has happened, and a kid goes missing, a kid who's been at a bar and shows up in the water, you assume the most natural assumption is that this person drowned and it's a horrible mistake. And so case closed, kid drowned, family heartbroken, claiming that it can't be possible. My kid would not do that.
Right.
Well, that happened over and over again. And these detectives figured, you know what, let's go from town to town and see if we can find anything that could potentially link all of these together.
All right, so you've mentioned these detectives a couple times. I guess we should introduce who we're talking about. These are two detectives from New York, New York City cops, who were closing in on their retirement, who got hooked into the story for their own reasons. Introduce them to the audience, because as of next week, I think they're going to become much better known.
I think you're right. It started in 1997 in New York. A young man named Patrick McNeil went missing. He was at a bar in New York City, and at the time, Kevin Gannon, a very accomplished third-generation NYPD, was on the case, and the kid came up at the right of the confluence of the East and Hudson Rivers. It was actually 11 miles away from where he went in. So he
and another cop. This was again a college kid.
Yep, a Fordham kid.
Yep, Fordham University student. He was the first of what started this investigation. We'll get back to this. Here's what I want to tell people too: is during the break, if they want to, they can log on to coasttocoastam.com. It'll take you directly to the link. If you look in the upper right hand corner, a link to Five Eyewitness News reporter Christy Peel's story. You can see the case as it's being laid out on the internet. They've included actually many more bits of information in the files. And when we come back, we'll tell you about how these two New York Police Department detectives began to assemble a case for this not being an accident or a series of accidents after all, but rather what they may reluctantly have to admit can only be called the smiley face killers. And we'll tell you why it's killers and not just killer coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. George getting a night off. I'll be back on tomorrow night on my usual night. John Abramson will join us. He's the author of Overdosed America. That's also the name of his website. You can hook up to that through coasttocoastam.com. Tomorrow night, we're talking about like these breaking drug study stories this week. Have you been following those? I mean, they're still coming, where drug companies have had to admit, as it turns out, we didn't do any kind of research at all. Oops. Do we say that? And I guess not a terrible surprise to John Abramson, but it's an admission which catches a lot of other people, especially people who have been taking these particular medications off guard. We'll pick that story up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the story we're talking about before we get to open lines later on, the story of a series of what had been dubbed accidents, accidental drownings, or suicides in the upper Midwest, throughout various college campuses, where young, good-looking, popular boys, young men, have gone missing after a night of partying, walking home alone. Suddenly, next time anybody finds them, after weeks, sometimes months, it's having been drowned in the river. And it wasn't always the same river, not always the same college campus, not the same state, but a series of them across the country that all fit the same profile. And the two retired NYPD detectives who, working with Christy Peel from 5 Eyewitness News here in the Twin Cities, I believe, are probably linked all across the country to some sort of murder club, some sort of organized gang that is perpetrating this. We'll tell you more about the smiley face killers coming up next. You'll hear it first on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're going pre-dawn a little bit on this story. It's a little bit before. You'll be hearing a lot more about it next week as both these two New York City police detectives, retired, and Christy Peel, reporter for 5 Eyewitness News, are looking for clues, people who might have another piece of the puzzle to this mystery. And that's just where we left it off, with a missing piece of the puzzle that detectives Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte were looking for in New York. They were investigating the death of a Fordham University college boy who had ended up at the Congress of the East in Hudson Rivers. And they were trying to figure out what happened to this kid. Now, what was the local ruling there? Accidental drowning?
Accidental drowning. And Gannon, it was his case. And when Patrick McNeil surfaced, he just thought something wasn't quite right. And it was shortly after, just a few days after his body was found, Kevin Gannon made a promise to Patrick McNeil's parents and said, "I promise you, I will devote my life to finding out what really happened to your son."
Now, what was his suspicion? Why couldn't it have been? It was just one. Why couldn't it have been one drunk kid falling in the drink?
He didn't think that it made sense that the body would, first of all, from where the bar was, you have to think about that body of water. It's so busy all the time. You know, New York City, so much traffic there. So right. What would have had to happen is that for that body to travel 11 miles through that busy waterway without anyone seeing it, and then it showing up in a rocky shore in the confluence, he just didn't think that it made sense.
Okay. And
he wasn't expecting any band of serial killers. He just thought something wasn't right.
Something wasn't right about that. So then he heard about the case, a similar sounding case in Minnesota, the Chris Jenkins case. Explain what that was about.
The Chris Jenkins case is really the case that kind of cracked this whole thing, because at the time that Chris Jenkins disappeared in 2002, Gannon and Duarte were already pretty convinced that there was something bigger going on. They had dozens of cases at that point and thought something around the country must be going on. They saw the Chris Jenkins case, and they told me from a few days after he was found in February of 2003, they knew he was murdered. The reason they knew he was murdered, they said, is because Chris Jenkins presented, when they found him in the water, on his back with his arms crossed across his chest with his hands clenched, and he was at a Halloween party at a bar when he disappeared, and so he was wearing a flimsy Halloween costume, and when he was found, the clogs on his feet were still on and his shirt was tucked in, and all of that to them said, this kid is murdered.
They said that because if a kid jumped in the river, the shirt would have popped out from his pants, the shoes would have come flying off. They're thinking that kid must have been just slipped into the river, or the shoes never would have stayed on.
Right. And if he would have been, even if it would have happened at the shoreline and he would have been, you know, somehow violently drowned and then just let off, their theory was that, well, if you're drowning and you're trying to save your life, you're thrashing. So things are going to come loose and your shoes are going to be off. So the reason that they thought that someone kind of placed him was because everything was so particular, and that he was, you know, just posed as if in a coffin.
All right. Now, this case is kind of particular to the Heartland, so no reason for other people to have known about this around the country. But it was big news when the police reversed themselves, the local police reversed themselves on Chris Jenkins and said, you know what, this one wasn't an accidental drowning. That was big, because up until that point, all of these had been accidental drownings.
That's right. And this was one, the police had a news conference and they said, we made a mistake. We apologize to the family. We made a mistake. This kid was murdered and the case is back open.
Okay. And that's when these two New York City police detectives stepped back into this case. And then they started looking at the pattern of these other disappearances, same type of thing. And then they started seeing the same pattern wasn't just happening in Minnesota and New York. Christy, explain all of the ways in which they began to track this across the country.
They were really just kind of perusing newspaper articles and things online, and when they would find a kid that matched their profile, they would dig a little bit deeper. And they finally got to a point where they thought that they had a group of 40 to 60 in 25 different cities in 11 different states, and they decided to basically take a couple-year road trip and went from town to town to town to see what they could find, if there was anything that was part of a bigger picture.
Mm. So what they started to find was how many states, how many cities, how many victims?
They believe upwards of 100, but with the ones that they have linked, they say are between 40 and 50. They have right now 11 different states, 25 different cities, and what's disturbing is that as we speak, the detectives are looking at one in Albany, New York. The kid was buried yesterday.
And it fits the same pattern of somebody going into the river and the police thinking it's just another one of those cases of too much alcohol and too little coordination or something.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And the father's out there, just like the Chris Jenkins parents were saying, there's something more here. It just doesn't make sense.
You know, and I think that's what we kept hearing about here. And again, we're talking with Christy Peel from 5 Eyewitness News in the Twin Cities. And Christy has been the lead investigator on this story that you can link up to through coasttocoastam.com. You could even watch one of Christy's reports. Or did you have another one tonight and I missed it in the 10 o'clock news?
Yes, we had one tonight, basically asking what are Minneapolis police and prosecutors doing now that they have this information from these detectives.
Well, we'll get back to that then, because I do want to know that, and I missed that news report. But you can link up to the story, you can watch the news story, and you can see how the story is just about to really go nationwide, and why these two New York City police detectives believe that somebody out there knows something. They may not even know that they know something, but there are clues that have been left at the scene. So let's talk about that. The clues that the police missed, who originally investigated all of these drownings, because all they were looking at was where the body washed up, not where the body went in.
And that's the key. These guys figured if this is a crime, then the crime scene isn't where they pulled the body out, it's where the body went in. So they started studying and getting experts and currents and water flow and temperature and all that sort of thing to figure out, okay, if the kid ended here, where did he go in? And when they got to that point, in their opinion, that's the crime scene, and that's where they started their investigation.
So talk about what they would find typically at these, at the sites where they believe the body would go in. They would show up at the site, they would map it out, they would say, aha, let's go over and look right here. And what did they find when they went to where that here was?
They would find very specific graffiti, very specific tagging, and these guys, you know, worked in the Bronx. They know what gang graffiti looks like, and they started finding things that looked different to them, and what they noticed city after city was a picture of a smiley face.
So the standard graffiti, the circle with the two eyes and the smile.
Yes.
And it was different look, maybe there's different colors, different sizes, but in crime scene after crime scene, they kept finding the smiley face.
And they would find other graffiti too. And what they've done for this story is they're hoping that there's going to be some sort of criminal prosecution at some point. So they've given me enough for, they're hoping some public pressure, but there's some, a lot of things that they're holding back. So they're telling me that there's other specific tagging, but they're not ready to talk about that yet. But the smiley face is the one thing they have seen over and over again.
How many times at these points where people went in, where they believe the men went into the river, how many times have they found a smiley face? Have they told you?
I know that it's more than a dozen. And wow. One of the things that is frustrating to them is that, you know, for example, the case in 97, the one that started this whole thing off, well, they didn't really realize that there may have been a bigger connection until, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later. So they can't go back to even see if it's there. Mm-hmm. So they believe that if they could have known all this way back when, they may have had a bigger number. But they are telling me that it's more than a dozen.
So the question that's being posed is, could there be a calculated cross-country plot to kill young college men in 11 different states, 25 different cities, but tied together through graffiti and the same MO of how these boys were supposedly killed? Now, the thought is that by putting the body in the river, too, you kind of cover a myriad of clues, right? I mean, it kind of washes away a lot of evidence. The body corrupts. It's harder to do autopsies. And also, if the police go into it thinking that it's an accident, they're not going to treat it like it's a murder victim.
That's right. I asked both of the detectives early on in this if they think that these people doing this are brilliant or lucky. And they told me both that they think that these people are both of those things. They are both intelligent in how they do this, and they're lucky in that they haven't gotten busted, and they think that these people are getting better at what they're doing.
The mother of Chris Jenkins, who was one of the victims here, one of the 18, maybe even 40 victims, young men in the upper Midwest who had been found drunk and drowned, that the mother of Chris Jenkins was in your report saying that she believes that that her son was kidnapped on the side of the road, mm-hmm. off a sidewalk, walking home, stumbling home, drunk from a party maybe, thrown into the back of a van, tortured, and then killed. And my impression from your news story, which again people can link up to at the website, my impression from the news story is that the two investigators from New York, the retired cops, didn't like the fact that she had said that in your news story. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know how to answer that because they haven't told me that they're not happy with her saying that.
So they don't mind her saying that. I mean, I wondered, did that sound like too much information for them? Were they trying to hold that back as part of what they were holding from the public knowledge because they want to tie this together more before they release it, or they were the ones that told her that. I guess that's what I'm trying to determine.
Yes. They gave her that information, and the reason that I think a little bit more information about the Chris Jenkins case is coming out in all of this is because they have told me, and we've made it public, that they believe they have enough, specifically in the Chris Jenkins case, that they have tried to take this to prosecutors, and I asked them in the story tonight, do you think you could pin this on some people? They said yes. I said, do you think if you took this to court, you could get some convictions? And they said yes. So in this particular case, they feel like they have names, they have MO, they have the whole business. Some of these other ones, I think that it's more of the group, and they have a real good feel about what happened. But in this Chris Jenkins case, because it's been labeled a murder, they have access to more files, to more information than some of the other ones that have been accidental drownings, case closed.
Okay. Well, I guess that brings us back to then to tonight's story, which you ran on the news and I missed, that in light of this report coming out last night, the one that you did, and the one I think is going to be featured Monday morning on Good Morning America,
yes,
that you were looking to see whether or not the local police or the FBI would readjust the way in which they've investigated these other accidental drownings. Was there any evidence of that today? Are police doing that publicly or privately at any level?
What happened is that these detectives, you know, like most cops, they aren't interested in all of the media attention. This was not their intention. I've been working with them for almost a year, and they never wanted to be in this position they're in. Their goal was always to bring people to justice, to get a criminal case going, and they were very disappointed when they took their information to Minneapolis police, and Minneapolis police said, no thanks, we don't need new theories, we want new evidence. So the Hennepin County Prosecutor's Office also wasn't interested, and they felt like they had no choice but to go public, hoping that public pressure would maybe change the minds of some of the officials.
Well, and I think they're looking, too, for more, whether anybody out there recognizes this smiley face thing, or even whether there might be other victims out there that they need to know about.
And, you know, since we aired the first story last night at 10 o'clock, our website has had more than 100,000 hits. I've gotten hundreds of emails. The phone calls are pouring in, and some of these emails are creepy. I mean, it's, hey, I think I was maybe could have been a victim, but my friends found me. Or, hey, my kid was mugged, and they showed up on the corner 10 hours later, and we think maybe they could have been a victim, but we're lucky. All these different stories are pouring in, and I've gotten so many emails from people who have sent me links to something that's happened in their city. We have a kid fitting this profile in our city. Can you send it to the detectives? Maybe it's connected.
Right. Now, why do these two New York City police detectives, retired, why do they think that this is a gang of some sort, a murder club of some sort?
And it's hard to really put a word on what they think it is, because they don't think this has ever been known about before, if that's the right way to say it. They believe that this is one kind of large group with the same goal of killing young men, among doing other criminal activities that they haven't told me specifically about, that have different pods in different cities that are focused there. So these groups aren't going from city to city to city. They're focused there, they're living there, they're doing their other criminal activities there, and part of that is the killing of these young men. That's what the detectives believe they've uncovered.
It actually reminds me, isn't the movie called Kiss the Girls? Does that sound familiar? With, I'm going to say Morgan Freeman and what's the Judd, the acting Judd?
Ashley.
Yeah, I think that was a plot in Kiss the Girls, that there was a internet-connected group that was showing off to each other, committing the same crime using the same MO, but in different cities at different times, and almost sort of a one-upmanship. But the whole idea just gives me the creeps, and we're not done yet. We'll give you the phone numbers coming up. They're looking for clues, looking for a way to try to catch these people. They're looking for other stories that might tie in to this investigation. Christy Peel has agreed to give us some more time. And when we come back, I want to ask her about the word Sinisawa. Sinisawa, that's what it is. One of the words found at the crime scene, one of the crime scenes, Sinisawa. At first, it stumped those two retired New York City police detectives. And then they think they figured it out. We'll tell you about that coming up next. On Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett.